In 2011, after 73 years in business, the Electrolux factory in Webster City closed its doors. It was a major blow for this small town, but the people of Webster City did not take the loss sitting down. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. This hour, Webster City, 6 years later. A new short documentary focuses on the growth of small businesses in Webster City following the factory closure. I'll talk with the man behind the documentary, as well as the mayor and a lifelong resident of Webster City. Later in the hour, we'll meet a young woman from Iowa City who is living her American dream. She and her family have been targeted by hate speech this year, but she decided to stand up for herself and organize her fellow students. Join the conversation after the news.
Support for IPR and this podcast comes from Valley View Village, an adult community offering a complete continuum of care, including independent living, assisted living, skilled and long-term care. Learn more about this community at valleyviewvillage.org.
It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. Later this hour, we'll meet Raneem Hamad. She's a young woman whose family has been targeted by hate speech in the past year. She turned adversity into an opportunity to make a difference and bring people together. I will talk with her later on. But first, this hour, Webster City. In 2011, after 73 years in business, the Electrolux factory in Webster City closed its doors. That was a major blow for a small town of about 8,000 people. Today, 6 years later, a new short documentary focuses on the growth of small businesses in Webster City and the resiliency of the town. We'll check in with Mayor John Hawkins and Jerry Cloberdance, a lifelong resident of Webster City. But first, Sean Conroy is here. He is the creative director of Square, a company that provides credit card processing solutions for small businesses. This documentary, Made in Iowa, is part of a film and web project that tells the stories of small businesses around the country. Hello, Sean. Sean, can you hear me? All right. We can't seem to get through to Sean, so we'll move on a little bit to Mayor John Hawkins. Hello, Mayor Hawkins.
Good morning. How are you today?
Great. Thank you so much for being here today.
No problem.
Well, and I want to talk a little bit about this documentary. I know there's been a showing in Webster City. A lot of people have had an opportunity to see it. And there's also a web build out that tells the story of Webster City a little bit more in depth. But I'd love to hear your reaction to seeing this short documentary. What did you think?
A good film. Positive. You know, it was a positive thing that the city came together and managed to save the theater. And that was the, you know, we went from everybody being down a bit, and it gave us a good reason to rally around. So yeah,
absolutely. And then, as you were just saying, I mean, the film tells the story of saving the theater in downtown Webster City. Although the story told online is a lot more about all of those empty storefronts downtown. That in 2013 there were 14 empty storefronts downtown. And of course, it wasn't just the Electrolux factory that closed. It was toward the end of what we're calling the Great Recession. It was a tough time economically everywhere, and of course in Iowa and in Webster City. So from your perspective, I know that the film makes maybe the time seem even worse than they were, and the comeback more dramatic than it was. But from your perspective, what have you seen happen in Webster City over the last 5 years?
Trying to rely on one big company and to employ everybody and have back the local, our local employers and have backed other people that have come to town. And of course, we've had a lot more support for small businesses to move to town. Different people who own buildings in town are given free rent, and a lot of different things they've tried to encourage people to move in.
So you really had to be creative to draw people into downtown?
I think that it's, I don't think, creative is the right word, and I don't think we're ever going to stop being creative from now on. I think that's probably what it's forced us to think outside the box most of the time now. So
Well, I want to bring Jerry Cloverdance into the conversation as well. Jerry, are you there?
Yes, I am.
Hi, Jerry. Thanks a lot for being here. And you've lived in Webster City most of your life. You worked at the Electrolux factory for 32 years?
That's correct.
So when Electrolux closed, and I know that you're also a former city council member, so when Electrolux closed, what was your reaction? I mean, I know you knew it was coming.
Well, I started working there on April 16th, 1979. And the day I walked in the door, people were talking about the plant closed. So that wasn't something unusual for this community. We've been hearing it for a long time. Now, in 2009, they made it official and said they were closing. At the time, it was, to me, it was devastating. Of course, I had worked there for 32 years, and I was hoping to retire from there. It was a good job and had good benefits. And, of course, you work with a lot of people over the years. You got to know them just like family. So it was like leaving part of your family. But for the community as a whole, it was, I don't want to say it was devastating. It was very hard on the community because there's a lot of people that weren't directly affected by the closing that live here. But there was the business, all the businesses in the community, of course, felt it right away. But you've got a lot of people that work in other communities and stuff, so they may have not been affected by it as much as at first. But then after a while, when, you know, your home prices started to fall and some of the other businesses started to close that you used to do business with, that started to have an effect.
Can you give me an idea of how dependent you feel Webster City was on the Electrolux factory? I mean, again, this is a town of about 8,000 people. So to have a huge employer like that nearby, and of course, not everybody in Webster City worked at the factory, but everybody had a connection, right?
Oh, yes. Yeah, not everybody worked at the factory, but you had all these other support businesses that supported the factory. And many of them closed after you had an Aero Acme, you had American Aluminum, you had several different other factories that were here at one time or another that helped, that supported that factory. And when they closed, it affected both. I think it was very, the whole community was very closely tied to the Electrolux facility.
Well, and Jerry, this happened, of course, 30 years after the farm crisis, but here in Iowa, we've seen so many small towns become shells of what they once were. Were you afraid that was going to happen to Webster City?
Well, of course. I mean, that's I was on the council at the time. As a matter of fact, when they announced the closure in October of 2009, I was in the process of running for re-election. So it was, you know, you worry about how it's going to affect the community. And like I said, I have seen the other communities in the state that have been affected by plant closures and, of course, the farm crisis and stuff. And you don't want to see that happen to your home community. You want to do everything you can to try to prevent that.
Well, and as I mentioned, by 2013, there were 14 empty storefronts downtown. So did you feel like it was happening to Webster City?
Yes, actually, I did. I did feel like it was starting to, you know, there was saying that it was going to dry up and blow away. There was those feelings with some of us within the community that thought that, you know, look at all these, you know, you used to go down the Main Street and there would be cars on Main Street and people and businesses open. And then you'd go down there, you go down there on a Friday evening and you could throw a rock and not hit a car. Mm-hmm. I mean, because it was basically Main Street was empty. But the people in this community are very resilient and they weren't going to settle for that. And I don't believe that we were going to sit back on our heels and do nothing. So everybody got together and started working to try to bring more business to town.
Well, and Mayor Hawkins, I'd love to ask you, clearly listening to you, you're not originally from Iowa. You're from Australia. What brought you to Webster City?
Really, it's, just came to visit. I'm not. They had a blues band on there, so
some people got together and had the blues band come to town, and I went and visited them and met my wife there. So that's probably my main reason I ended up in Webster City.
All right, so love brought you to Webster City.
Yeah.
Nice. And when you, being fairly new to Webster City, saw the town start to go through this transformation, what was your reaction?
You know, definitely worried for them. You know, my business doesn't rely on anybody in town, but I do employ a lot of people in town. And so, you know, it was definitely a worry for everybody, and seeing the town losing different businesses. And as Jerry said, you know, we lost quite a few big businesses, you know, Beam and Terry Acme. So it was definitely suffering, that's for sure.
And you became a city councilman 4 years ago. You've been the mayor for a year. So you kind of jumped into the mix politically as this recovery was really beginning to take off. What inspired you to run for office?
I'm not exactly sure. I got talked into it, I think, is what the reason I ended up in it. But I guess to try and help out, that was the main reason I ran. So.
Well, tell me, now that you have a little bit of an outsider's perspective, but you're also, I know, a proud mayor, what makes Webster City a special place?
I think the closeness of it. It's a small enough town, but, you know, it's still a town where you feel like you know everybody in town. People still stop and say hello to you, and you know, if someone does something, generally we get together and we try and help out. So I think that's the beauty of it.
Jerry, what do you think? What would you add to that?
Well, I think it's the people. I mean, it's all about people in the community and, working together and being there for one another. I mean, that's what makes Webster City, Webster City. I mean, if there's an issue or something that needs to be done, whether it's a parade or if it's somebody having some bad luck, there's always somebody there to help you out.
Do you... In trying to attract new people to come into town, as we've talked about creativity, but what's your main selling point if you try to tell people, you know, give Webster City a look? Jerry?
Well, I would say that we have a very good workforce that's here. We've got good quality of life, excellent schools, and there's a lot of opportunities here. There's just a lot of things to do and a lot of opportunities if you look at it. I mean, one of the things with Webster City is the people who live here. Sometimes we can't see the forest for the trees. You don't always see all the beautiful things that we have going on here until somebody else from the outside comes in and points them out to you.
Well, and we'll talk to somebody from the outside in just a few minutes, but Jerry Cloberdance, you stay with us. Mayor John Hawkins, you stay with us as well. We'll be talking to Sean Conroy from Square in just a few minutes. And if you live in Webster City or have lived in Webster City, we'd love to hear your thoughts as well. Give us a call, 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at IPR Talk. You can send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. This is Talk of Iowa. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. Coming up in about 15 minutes, I'll talk with a young woman who is living her American dream and affecting a lot of people in a positive way along the way. That's coming up in a few minutes. But right now we're talking about Webster City. Back in 2011, after 73 years in business, the Electrolux factory in Webster City closed down. This town only has about 8,000 people, so it was a major blow to the community. And over the last 6 years, there's been an impressive comeback in Webster City, a thriving downtown district now. The story of this town was recently told in a short documentary that's posted online. It's called Made in Iowa, and it's a project by Square, which is a company that provides credit card processing solutions for small businesses. This project is telling the stories of different small businesses around the country, and Sean Conroy is the creative director of Square. He is with me now. Hello, Sean.
Hi, Charity. Thanks for having me on.
Yeah, wonderful to hear your voice. So, Sean, give me a little bit of background about this project. What's the idea behind it?
Yeah, so at Square, we've always sort of told the stories of these really exceptional small business owners that use our services. But this series, For Every Kind of Dream, we're able to go a little bit deeper, spend a little more time with them, and sort of turn their stories into short films without ever mentioning Square. And we set out to sort of create a tapestry of American small business, sort of check in on the state of the American dream. And for our first film, Yassine Falafel, we shared the story of a Syrian refugee in Knoxville, Tennessee, who built a falafel cafe out of nothing. And for the second one, we wanted to find kind of a heartland story and something sort of more rooted in longstanding America. And we started casting around, and we found Webster City.
So how did you find Webster City? What drew you to it?
Yeah, so we found this, you know, finding a story this amazing takes a while and takes a lot of work and a lot of Googling, to be honest. We found this New York Times photo essay about Webster City sort of post-Electrolux closing. And then we found this sort of rebuttal that the then Chamber of Commerce director Deb Brown wrote in saying, now, wait a minute, we have a lot of great stuff going on here in Webster City. And we were intrigued and we flew out there, and she was right. And she sort of told us the story of the movie theater and the revitalization of Second Street. And we said, we have a story here. And that's how we found it.
So in telling that story, obviously this is a short documentary, but mm-hmm. what did you feel was the most important thing to share about what you saw in Webster City?
The resilience of the people. Kay Ross, who's one of the women we feature in the film, said, you know, something that really stuck with us. She said, people think that we're stuck here. People don't realize we make a choice to stay here. And that is sort of the key takeaway we want people to get from this film, which is everybody in Webster City faced down this choice of stay or go. And, you know, maybe leaving is the easy choice, but so many people said, we're going to come together and we're going to reinvest in our community and we're going to sort of save our town. And they really did it themselves with a focus on small and local business. They didn't look for outside help. They just sort of buckled down, reinvested in their local economy, diversified it, and are really on the way back.
We're talking about the resiliency of Webster City. With me is Sean Conroy, creative director of Square, the people behind this documentary made in Iowa. Also with me, Mayor John Hawkins of Webster City and Jerry Cloberdance, lifelong resident of Webster City. And Jerry, I'd love to ask you, because this film kind of focuses on the moment that the theater closed downtown. Do you remember when the theater closed?
Oh, yes. Yeah, it was a very sad day for me. I mean, I'm a movie buff. I love going to movies. And when they decided that they wanted to close, or the theater closed, of course, it was owned by an outside company that didn't have any ties to Webster City. It was a corporation. They just decided to close it. They closed a lot of other small theaters and communities. And it was just like the day they closed Electrolux to me, because I spent a lot of time in that movie theater, and all of a sudden now it wasn't there.
Well, so it was really an emotional blow. I mean, it wasn't just a business closing. It stood for a lot more than that.
Yeah, it stood for a lot more than just losing, you know, half a dozen jobs. It stood for, you know, this is where you take your family for, you know, a night out with your family. You take them to the movies. You know, you go out for supper and you go to the movies and you spend time with your kids and grandkids and, you know, girlfriends, boyfriends, and your spouses. You know, this is some of the things that you do. And when they decided to close the theater, I'm thinking, oh my God, where am I going to go to the movie at now? You know, I don't want to drive to Fort Dodge or to Ames or any place else. I want to be able to go see a movie in Webster City.
Do you feel like in many ways that was a moment that galvanized people in Webster City, that made a lot of people say, hey, we really do need to work together to make this a livable community?
Oh, I think so. I think that Jeff Pingle was instrumental with getting the movie back up and get the theater back open. He started a Facebook page on the day that it closed and said if he got 100 likes, he would. You know, we knew that there was more people that supported him. Well, he got 1,000 that night before midnight. So
wow.
That was one of the things that inspired us to. Jeff and I had talked about buying the movie together, the theater together, and doing it. But of course, you know, with both of us losing our, you know, I lost my job, and there was other, his spouse had lost her job. So it was, you know, that wasn't going to happen. But the community, we decided to form this nonprofit to try to bring it back. Like many other small communities are doing the same thing, and we decided to do the same thing, and it worked. It's worked very well.
Well, and Sean, I think Jerry just described perfectly why you probably focused on the theater in downtown Webster City. But is there anything you want to add to that? Why a theater is not going to be the business that really makes or break a town economically, but it's really the heart of this little downtown.
Yeah, that's right. And, you know, the theater is a historic movie theater, and it had been around for decades. And so for that closing, as Jerry said, felt very emotional for the town. And also it's the centerpiece of the Main Street. You know, it's symbolic. And when that shuttered, you know, for in making this with our partners at Even Odd Films, we were there for 9 days. We did 17 interviews. These were 9 14-hour production days. We really talked to a lot of people, shot a lot of stuff. We joked that we were just a couple days of production away from making it a full-length feature documentary. And you know, the theater, in making a short documentary, you have to constrain yourself. And we chose to tell the story of the theater because of what it represents. And you know, in the film, people say when that marquee lit up, it was like a sign of hope for the town. And that has sort of, because it's the symbol of Main Street, because that marquee puts out so much light, the people in town share stories of how that sort of helped revitalize Second Street, and people feel excited and sort of willing to open businesses downtown again.
Well, and the experience of being able to bring that theater back, I mean, not only does it give people hope, but the experience of success that had to affect people as well.
Yeah, I mean, we couldn't believe that they did it, and we were in chatting with Jeff and Kay and Jerry about their experiences. The doubts that they came up against were, you know, considerable. And I think it was Jeff says, you know, at first they told us we could never do it. And then they said it would take us 3 years, and then they did it in 16 months, you know. And this is at a time when this is all out, you know, fundraising from people in town. As Kay said, it was $5 at a time. And this is at a time when the town was struggling. You know, not people don't have disposable income to just throw to movie theater. And so for them to do this at that time, in spite of all that, we found just to be pretty remarkable.
So what do you think you learned, and the other filmmakers, what do you think you learned from the process of making this documentary?
That's a good question. Give ourselves more time to produce it next time. 17 interviews is a lot. And maybe someday we can make that feature-length documentary. You know, look, I'll be honest. We all were based in San Francisco. I had never been to Iowa. And all of the stereotypes about Midwest niceties are totally true. We made great friends. Everybody was so welcoming and so eager to share their story and so open about what they had gone through and what they're, you know, in some ways still going through and coming out the other side of. And, you know, Jerry took us to the dirt track races, and that was totally new. And that was, you know, a highlight. And we're now in conversation about bringing the people we shot with, Jerry and Kay and Jeff, out to San Francisco in a couple of weeks to meet everybody here at Square and hang out with us.
So maybe you learned that there's a little bit more in the heartland than you originally thought.
That might be true, yeah.
So now, obviously, Square has a reason for promoting the success stories of small businesses, because that is your business. But I'd love to hear your take. I mean, as we've been recovering from the Great Recession, a lot of people have been investing in small businesses. They've had to be creative to stay where they want to stay or to create their own opportunities. How have you seen, from your perspective, our economy changing for small businesses?
I think that what we're trying to sort of highlight with this series and as a company is that small and local business can drive forward meaningful change on a lot of different levels, right? And in fact, there was a 2015 study by the EPA, the Environmental Protection Agency, that showed that towns that invested in their local economies and if they had a historic downtown to invest in, like in the case of Webster City, towns that chose to invest in their local economies and reinvest in their historic downtowns recovered from the Great Recession at a faster rate than similar sized towns. And that's exactly what we've seen with Webster City. They're sort of, they whether deliberately or not, chose to invest in small and local and have made that comeback. And of course, you know, that is Square's business, is small business. But small business employs something like 99% of American employees. It is our economy, right? And so and there's so many stories of like the Webster movie theater, or like Yassine Tarun in Knoxville that we've been able to feature. We just, you know, can't run the camera fast enough, to be honest with you.
Well, Sean, thank you so much for talking with me today.
Thank you so much for having us, Jody.
Sean Conroy of Square, which is a company that provides credit card processing solutions for small businesses, but they're also working on this documentary and web project to feature small businesses around the country. They did a feature on Webster City, the resiliency of this community. Still with me, Mayor John Hawkins and Jerry Cloberdance, lifelong resident of Webster City. And Jerry, Sean was talking about going to the dirt track races in Webster City. Tell me a little bit more about the culture of Webster City. And do you feel that the process of bringing this theater back and the comeback from the loss of Electrolux, has that changed the culture in Webster City?
Oh, I think it's definitely changed the culture as far as being dependent upon a corporation for jobs. I don't think that we are looking, I know many people have said that we don't want another big factory to come back here to Webster City and try to, quote, save us. We would rather have small local businesses started up, small companies come in from outside the community to come into our community and bring jobs. I mean, we're not going to depend on one company to give us jobs like we had in the past.
There have been a lot of books written and essays written about how in modern life we're more isolated than we used to be. Do you think that this helped Webster City create a stronger sense of community than it had, at least, you know, just before this, not in deep history, but in the recent decades?
Well, I think Webster City, small town Iowa. I mean, if you see somebody having a problem on the side of the road, you stop and help them. I don't think that's ever going to change here. I don't think it's ever changed. That's always been, you know, like Sean said, Iowa nice. We are Iowa nice. We take care of one another. And I don't think that's ever going to change. I think, as a matter of fact, it's becoming stronger in this community because of the things that they do, that we've done. And it's all about the community. It's not about any individual or group of individuals. It's about the people in the community and how they respond to one another. You know, you try to know your neighbors. You try to be supportive of them. And I think we do that here in Iowa.
Mayor Hawkins, I know Webster City has worked hard to diversify. There are some other strong local businesses. The McMurray Hatchery has been going strong for a long time and really has been helped out by the backyard chicken craze. There are some other strong little businesses, a fish farm that's growing right now. But when you look to the future, what do you think the main challenges are for Webster City?
The main challenge now actually is going to be trying to get enough people to move to town to for these people to grow. That's seems probably our biggest challenge right now.
Really? So you, I mean, I know that unemployment, and of course unemployment levels in Iowa have gone much lower than they were during the recession. I know Webster City topped out at about 10% unemployment. Mm. And so you feel like getting a workforce is now the challenge. You need more people.
Yes, we do. Everyone in town's hiring, and there's not enough people for the jobs that are available. So, and, you know, there's other businesses moving to the area, so it's going to make it tighter still.
All right. So give me your best pitch. Why should somebody come and look at jobs in Webster City?
Because of our community pride, and we have great schools. We have a community center for the children, great library. And just a beautiful town with a nice river running through it. You go canoeing and whatever on the weekends, or tubing or anything else you want to do. Biking, we got bike trails, go out to Briggs Woods, one of the oldest parks in the state. So.
And you've got a great little movie theater.
When we do. Great movie theater, a lot of other good things, so yeah. But now we have a beautiful movie theater.
Well,
and
Mayor,
as I said, it is the center of downtown.
Right. Mayor John Hawkins, thank you for talking with me today.
Thank you.
Mayor John Hawkins of Webster City. Jerry, I'd love for you to look into the future. What do you think the main challenges are for Webster City?
Well, I think Mayor Hawkins is right. We need to have more people come to the community for the jobs that are available. There's going to be a lot more that are going to be coming here in the future. We've got the Prestige Hog Confinement or Hog Processing Plant that's going to be going in about 12 miles away from us, and all the other jobs that are coming here right now, you know, with the fish farm and all the existing businesses that have continued to expand and add people. That is going to be one of the biggest challenges that we'll have, is to bring people to the community.
All right. Well, Jerry, thank you so much for talking with me today.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you.
Jerry Cloberdance, a lifelong resident of Webster City. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. Coming up in just a moment, I'll be talking to Raneem Hamad. She is the valedictorian of West High in Iowa City, and she's had a very eventful year over the past year. Her family has been a target of hate speech, and she decided to take that adversity and turn it into an opportunity to make change and bring people closer together. Again, we were talking about Webster City this hour. If you'd like to see the documentary that started this conversation, you can find a link to it on our Twitter feed at IPR Talk. I'm also there at Charity Nebbe. And you can also go to squareup.com/dreams. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. Raneem Hamad of Iowa City describes her first 3 years of high school as boring, but her senior year was anything but. Hamad graduated from Iowa City's West High School as the class valedictorian, but the accomplishments she's most proud of this year have very little to do with her academic performance. Following the election of 2016, she and the other members of her family were the targets of hate speech, and she decided to speak out at school and in the community. And Raneem Hamad is with me now. Hello, Raneem.
Hello.
Thank you so much for being here.
No problem.
Well, give us a little bit of background about your family. You are American citizens, but where did your family originally come from?
Well, my family's from Sudan, obviously, but I didn't really live in Sudan for most of my childhood. I lived in the Middle East. I lived in Oman mostly. And then I think when I was 9, we moved over to the United States.
All right. So yeah. You were 9 years old when you moved to the United States. You have 3 younger siblings.
Yes.
And when you moved here, did anybody in your family, did you speak English?
Yeah, actually, we all spoke English because we went to a private school in Oman, and they taught in English, I guess, like a British curriculum kind of. And so we all spoke English, but in a kind of like a thick accent that's way different than the American accent. But other than my mom was the only one who didn't really speak English, I guess. Yeah.
Do you remember how you felt when you learned that you'd be moving to the United States?
I was mostly excited, I guess. I was going to miss my friends, and the last day I was kind of sad because you were all like crying and everything. But then I got over that very quickly, and I was just excited to see this new place and like the big cities and everything, because the first city we moved to was Philadelphia.
All right.
So that was a big change, yeah.
When you learned you were going to move to Iowa, had you even heard of Iowa?
No, I never heard of it. I was kind of confused about the spelling, too. I was like, Iowa? What kind of name is that?
It's a lot of vowels.
Yeah. But now that I'm here, I mean, it's kind of my second home, basically, where I grew up. Yeah.
So when your family moved to Iowa City, as you mentioned, there is a large Sudanese population in Iowa City. When you were going to school in elementary school and junior high, did you feel accepted?
Well, I went to Roosevelt before it closed, and there were a lot of like different kids. It was very diverse compared to a bunch of other elementary schools that I know. And I did feel accepted because there were a lot of Sudanese kids, but there were also kids from different places in the world, Ethiopia. I have my best friend is Ethiopian, and a lot of people from I have another best friend who was Russian, and from another best friend that was Polish. So like I had a lot of like different people that had different backgrounds around me. So I didn't feel different, because I mean, they probably felt different too if I felt different. And I felt that was accepting. And then as I moved up, just like once I went to junior high, I realized that it's like the area around me is not as diverse as I thought it was. And then when I went to high school, like it hits you more, I guess, as you go up the education ladder, I guess.
That's interesting. And when I visit schools, often I will notice that, for example, in the lunchroom, the lunchroom looks segregated.
Yeah. Yeah.
Is that something you experience?
Yeah. I actually, now that you say that, I realize that a lot because in the mornings, like mostly a lot of like the minority kids, I guess, hang out in the cafeteria in the mornings. And like there's like the Sudanese girl area and then the boys, Sudanese boys sit on a different side. And then like for example, African-American kids sit on the other side. And like if there are any like white kids, they sit on it. Like it is kind of segregated now that you say that. But I don't think that happened on purpose. I guess it's just a group of friends you have. And then I guess, I mean, in lunch too, I kind of see that now, like the ELL kids sit together and then like the popular kids sit on their own. Like, I mean, I don't know if it's like on purpose. I think it just happens because like the circles around you and like the group of friends you have, I guess.
Right. People feel comfortable with this group of people.
Yeah.
And so they hang out with this group of people.
They don't go out of their groups a lot.
So as I mentioned, you've described the first 3 years of high school as being pretty boring, pretty uneventful. Obviously, you're a very good student. Things changed a lot, though, this year.
Yes, a lot.
During the election season, I know things changed a lot right after the election, but in the buildup to the election, was there tension at school?
Somewhat. I mean, until Saad started, our group, Students Against Hate and Discrimination, started actually doing stuff around school, it wasn't like out there as much. It was kind of like passive aggressive tension kind of. And like, you know, like you realize that this group of kids, oh, these are the Hillary kids and these are the Trump kids who wore their Trump hats. And like there was that kind of tension, like kind of passive tension. I guess people felt more emboldened after the election to like come out and like do those things that they did.
So after the election, something that happened to your family, and this is something that got quite a bit of attention in the newspapers and in the press, somebody put a hateful note on your family's door. Can you tell me what happened?
Well, I think that night we were all going to bed, and then my dad, for some reason, he was like, he left our house, he left, and he came back at like 11 o'clock, and he left at 10, I feel like, and he left back in an hour. He came back in an hour, and he found the note on the door. So, like, in that matter of time, like, we were asleep. We didn't really know anything. And so my dad comes back, and he's like, oh, guys, did you see this? Did you see anyone come up to our door, to the house or anything? We're like, no, we were asleep. And then he's like, well, I found this on the door. And then we look at the note, and I was shocked, to be honest, and because I didn't expect that to happen, like, directly, like, our neighborhood is pretty quiet. There's not a lot of people that walk around, I mean, at night especially. And so I was kind of surprised that it actually happened.
And the note, we're not going to repeat exactly what it said, but it used the N-word. It basically told you to get out.
Yeah. It used the N-word. It called us terrorists and a bunch of other stuff.
How did you feel when you read that?
After the first, like, initial shock, and then I realized that, like, I realized that I shouldn't really be shocked because this is kind of, I expected it to happen somewhat, like to someone, I mean, and like now that person is me, I mean, our family, I guess. But like after what happened to my sister, like a couple days before, and then that happened.
So what happened to your sister?
She was called in the cafeteria. This kid came up to her while they were getting out of the lunch line, and he told her to, I'm not going to use the words that he said, but he told her to basically get out of the country. Like, you're not supposed to be here.
So your sister gets yelled at school with hateful, racist language.
Mm-hmm.
You get this note on your doorway of your home.
Mm-hmm.
Did you feel like your family was being singled out, like you were being attacked?
I felt more of like my community was being attacked mostly because like the reason my sister was singled out is because she was wearing a scarf on her head. And then the reason we were singled out is because we are a minority family with a Habitat home in a mostly white neighborhood. So I feel like when that happened, I felt affected as a community, not just ourselves, because that could have happened to a bunch of other people also, you know what I mean? And so,
and I need to mention, when your dad called the police about this note, they didn't send anybody.
No.
They told him to throw the note away. And
the police officer just told him there's nothing I can do, just throw the note away. And my dad was shocked that that was how the police officer
And the
reacted.
Department has said that they should not have responded that way. But you decided to post that note on social media.
Yes. Because at that point, I mean, now too, I feel like social media is like the way for me to be able to express myself and show people what is happening, and so that they're not just blinded by like regular stuff happening in their day-to-day lives. And I feel the responses I got from my friends, from like family members on social media, and other people that I my parents, my family, my mom, my mom's Facebook and everything, the responses were amazing. But at the same time, that still doesn't take away the what happened.
But people were shocked that it could happen here.
Yeah. Yeah.
So you spent a lot of the rest of the year speaking out and trying to make a difference. Did you have a moment where you decided that you personally needed to do something?
Yeah, I think it was right after the note. Actually, the next day, the next morning, I was talking to my sister and I was like, I'm kind of fed up with what is happening. Like, this is, if no one does, we can't just keep putting it under the rug. Oh, it's fine. Let's like ignore it. Because at some point, if you just keep ignoring it, it's not going to stop. And people aren't going to know what's actually happening in their own city, in their own hometown. And so that morning, my sister and I decided that we wanted to do something. And then the next day in school, got together with a group of friends. We actually had the same conversation, like, we should do something. This is not right. We need to show our people in our city that this is happening and this is wrong. And we got together that afternoon, actually, in school. There was a protest, actually, that same week. And then after that protest, we got together after school, and with the help of Mazahir Saleh from the CWJ, the Center for Work and Justice, we decided to create our organization and start speaking out.
With Students Against Hate and Discrimination.
Yes.
I have seen your face in the newspaper so many times this year. From that point on, I mean, you were involved in organizing protests, in recruiting students to be a part of this group, but also in leading protests in the community. On the pedestrian mall, there was a large protest against the travel ban.
Yes.
And you were up on a stage. You were wearing an American flag hijab. Mm-hmm. You were addressing the crowd through a bullhorn at times. Mm-hmm. What was that like for you?
It was an amazing feeling, actually. I guess at first I was nervous, I guess, but then after the first protest, all the nerves kind of just went away and I just fell in love with it. And it was an amazing feeling, and to see the crowd ahead of, like, in front of you, and everyone supporting you and agreeing with you at the same time, like, yeah, we agree, this is wrong, people need to speak out. It was an amazing feeling.
What do you think you accomplished this year?
I think the most important thing is knowledge, I guess, for me. Like, people are more aware of their surroundings and what is happening, and not just Iowa City, but in the world too, and in our nation. And that's an important thing for me. And I've also, another thing that we accomplished is making students feel that they can do something and that they have a voice. And I hope that other students were inspired, that they could go to the school board and that they can talk to these adults that are behind closed doors and you never see them, and that they actually, what their actions affect you as well, and that you can actually go up there and talk to them and talk to them to, like, help you, because their job is to help you in the end.
And did you feel like the school board, did you feel like the administrators responded to you?
Well, school administrators at first, we didn't have a feeling that they were responding to us, which is why we went to the school board, because we didn't feel like our administration at West High was helping us in the beginning. And so, but after we went to the school board, the support we also got from the school board was also pretty great, because they did agree to follow our we had like a list of things we wanted to get done, and they did go through the list with us, and they were like accepting of what we wanted, and they released a message against that went throughout both high schools, again, that was against the hate and that was happening in our schools at the time. And they agreed, now they also agreed to start thinking about planning a diversity class that we're going to have, hopefully, that will hopefully combat, like, the hate and the ignorance at a younger age so that events like what happened to my sister or my other friends don't keep happening again in the future.
As students at West High, we're also on a national television talk show. This is something that got a lot of attention. But watching that on TV, there were students from both sides of the divide. Mm-hmm. And the idea was to open up a dialogue.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not sure I felt that in watching that. But do you feel like you made progress with the other students at school? Do you feel like you were able to connect with some people who maybe were thinking those hateful things or saying those hateful things?
Well, I definitely, there's obviously a group that you can get through to no matter what. And that was the group that was making fun of us while we were sitting down in our sit-in and making crude jokes in the background. But at the same time, there's that middle people, the group of kids who are in the middle and like, they want to know more, but they don't want to like look like, oh, they don't want to do it in front of everyone, in front of their friends. And I feel like we did get through those kids because there are a lot of kids that I've never seen before that came up to me and were telling me, oh, I support you, but this is, I agree, I don't like what's happening and blah, blah, blah. And I feel like our group did get through to some kids in the end. No matter, I mean, you can't get through to everyone, but the few that we did get through to, I'm glad for that. I'm thankful for that.
So do you think that if the school district starts teaching about diversity in a more active way, maybe those school cafeterias won't look so segregated in the future?
I don't think that's the only solution. That's part of it. I guess it's a step forward in the right direction. But I mean, in the end, the kid, like, you can't force kids to sit with someone they're not going to be comfortable with. But I feel like the classes, like getting kids to, not forcing them, I guess, but like you have to, like, in the end, get them to be able to have conversations about topics they might not feel comfortable about. And I feel like having those conversations are, in the end, what helps us realize that the other side is also a human being, that they also have feelings, that they also can connect with you in a personal level. And I feel like this class is a step in the right direction, but I feel like there are still more steps and actions to be taken in the future too.
So what are your plans for next year?
I'm going to be attending Columbia University in New York.
Wow.
And that's coming up pretty soon, actually, 2 months left. But I definitely don't want to just end what I did in high school. I want to keep doing what I love in Columbia as well, and hopefully find another space for myself to be able to talk about these kind of issues as well.
What do you want to be when you get done with college?
I don't know, actually, because it's changing every day. But so far, I'm probably going to major in biology, but I'm also interested in human rights and political science as well. But we'll see what happens. I mean, I'm not sure yet.
After that hateful note was put on the door of your family's home, there was also an outpouring of love and support from many members of the community, not just members of the Sudanese or the Muslim community, but from many members of the community.
Mm-hmm.
How do you think your family feels about living in Iowa City right now?
I don't think anything has changed in that, like, in that area, because Iowa City is still our home, no matter who comes and tells us that it's not or tries to show us that we're not welcome here. It is still our home because we still live here and we go to school here and we work here and we have family and friends here. So that, you can't take that away from us, no one can take that away from you. And I think actually the note and the support that we got just showed us that this is our home, all, like, no matter who tries to make you think it isn't.
Raneem, thank you so much for talking with me today.
No problem. Thank you.
Raneem Hamad. She lives in Iowa City and was the valedictorian for West High this year. Also one of the student founders of the group Students Against Hate and Discrimination. I'm Charity Nebbe. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio.